Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. Ong, clinical sexologist, with Sander Kegg, licensed clinical social worker. Our guest this hour is Dr. Mary Ann Horton, a computer scientist and transgender activist, here to discuss transgender inclusion in the workplace and her award-winning memoir, Trailblazer. Welcome to the show, Mary Ann.
Thanks, Dr. Ahn. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you come out as trans?
Well, most trans people will tell you that they knew from a very early age that they were trans, and that wasn't true for me. I thought I was a perfectly ordinary little boy. I played with trucks and race cars, and that all changed in 1965 when my mom took me to see The Sound of Music, and there was a number in there, 16 going on 17, where Liesel is dancing with Rolf in the gazebo and her dress is whirling and bouncing and doing amazing things. And suddenly it just hit me that I wanted to wear that dress and twirl like that. And I did what every red-blooded American crossdresser does. I snuck into my mom's room and stole some of her clothes and tried them on, and it felt good. And I found out very quickly from my mother that that was not okay. So I had to hide them. I made a stash in my closet. And I grew up as a closeted crossdresser and had no inkling that I would progress beyond that.
I'm wondering, Mary Ann, you talk about transgender inclusion in the workplace, and I would love to hear anything you have to say on that topic, especially now. It's February 2025. We're in the United States. There's all kinds of things happening, but not a lot of people are familiar with what has happened in the past around creating inclusion in the workplace, specifically around transgender people or issues in the workplace. I'd love to hear just a story about what was your involvement in that and how did it get started and what were some of the successes, and that'll probably lead us down some other roads.
Oh, sure. I've definitely got stories. I was very closeted. I couldn't tell anyone. I was very afraid, and that went for work as well. But in 1996, I was working for AT&T, Bell Labs, and it spun off Lucent Technologies, which I went with Lucent. And I saw a poster on the wall for Equal at Lucent Technologies, which was the employee resource group. And they advertised themselves as being for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender workers. I'd never seen the word transgender in the workplace before. So that drew me in. And I got involved with Equal and found out they were a great group of people. And I was the first trans person to show up. So I educated them about trans, and they educated me about gay and lesbian. Well, I went to a conference. Equal had an annual conference in Denver in 1997. And they were very, very proud that they had sexual orientation in their non-discrimination policy. And that enabled them, as gay and lesbian people, to put their partner's picture on their desk and talk about what they did that weekend and not have to spend energy making up stories and being in the closet. But by not spending that energy on hiding, they became better workers, more productive workers, because they had more energy for their job. And I thought that was a wonderful thing. And I wanted to come out too, because I was spending a lot of energy hiding myself. But the non-discrimination policy said sexual orientation, and it didn't have anything in it about transgender. So I couldn't. Being involved with Equal, I was allowed to network with the folks. And I asked, would it be possible to have transgender inclusive language put into their equal opportunity policy? And that request went up the chain to HR. And a few months later, a question came back. Well, if we did have transgender inclusive language in our non-discrimination policy, what language should we use in order to be as inclusive as possible? And I'm like, wow, I don't have the answer to this, but this is a great opportunity. I'd better find out. So I'd been networking with some activists in DC and I had some contacts. So I asked them, what language should we use? And the model language that they were working from at the time in 97 was gender identity, sex and gender characteristics, and gender expression, which is a lot. That's a mouthful. It was intended to protect transsexuals with the gender identity and intersex people with the sex and gender characteristics, and just about everybody with gender expression, you know, crossdressers, transsexuals, feminists, everybody. So I sent that language up the chain, and the response that came back was, I don't know about this. This is not so good. This sex characteristics thing, does that mean you can drop your pants in the workplace? And so it seemed it was time to do a little bit of wordsmithing. So I simplified it and said, let's just use gender identity characteristics or expression, which still protects all the same people. And it's a lot easier wording. Sent that back up, didn't hear anything for a few months. And then on October 22 of 1997, Lucent had an all hands meeting about diversity and unveiled their new equal opportunity non-discrimination policy. And in there, right after sexual orientation, was the language, gender identity characteristics or expression. So I celebrate. This was wonderful. Lucent was the first Fortune 500 company to include trans language in their non-discrimination policy. That was historical. And I am delighted to have been the instigator to get that policy through.
That not only is that a wonderful effort that you led, but it sounds as if it's possible that it started a domino effect. Did you hear about that? That people heard what you did at Lucent and they tried to do it at their company? Was there some sort of communication going on, maybe on a listserv or through conferences, that people were like, oh, I wonder if we can do that at my company? Did you ever hear from people who followed up with you saying, thank you for that example, I'm going to do it at my workplace?
Oh, it wasn't just about hearing about it. I had to get involved and help make it happen. But yes, I went to the Out and Equal conference in Rochester and networked with the other seven trans people that were there. At least I wasn't the token trans person for once. And with the other employee resource groups. And I was very excited about this news from Lucent. So I shared it. I was waving the flag. I was very, very proud of this. And I'm saying, your company ought to do this too. So in 1998, I heard from a trans woman at Apple, and she wanted to get the policy through. So I connected her HR person with the HR person at Lucent. And in 1998, Apple added the exact same language, gender identity characteristics or expression, to their policy. And then it took a few years to get the snowball rolling a little bit more. In 2001, we had a benchmark between Lucent and IBM and Chase and Xerox. And we all talked about how to do this. And they took the benchmark results back to their HR organizations, and IBM, Chase, and Xerox added it pretty quickly. I think it was in 2001. American Airlines also added it at about the same time. I didn't have any involvement in that. There was a trans pilot who was instrumental in getting that through. And a few years later, the Human Rights Campaign started off the Corporate Equality Index. And I asked them to include trans points in their index. And I wasn't the only one asking. There were a lot of activists pushing on HRC to include trans. And so they included 10% for having a trans language in their non-discrimination policy. So at that point, HRC was the big carrot. And everybody wanted that 100% rating on the Corporate Equality Index. So the snowball was rolling on its own. I didn't have to push it anymore, which was great. I could focus on other stuff.
Were you ever involved in business council that HRC had that was, I'm not sure exactly how they were connected to the Corporate Equality Index, but I think they must have informed it to a certain degree. Jamison Green was on it. I think maybe Donna Rose might have been on the business council, but I'm not sure. Did you ever have any involvement with the business council at HRC?
Almost. They asked me to be on it, and my plate was full at the time with boards that I was on. So I turned it down, and Donna Rose wound up being the person who took that slot.
I would imagine there was a time when people would look out, they'd be like, oh, we need trans people on our board, but they didn't see hundreds or thousands of available people. People were on two or three boards in some cases. So it makes sense that they would invite you for that. And Donna Rose, she's been on other boards as well. So, and even Jamison Green. Yeah. So
Donna's amazing. Yeah, Jamison's awesome too.
Yeah.
Those two have done so much wonderful work for the community. The trans community wanted to be on boards initially, and it was challenging for us. We wanted to be on the Stonewall Columbus board. And this was in 99, I think it was. And we were having a meeting of It's Time Ohio, three of us trans activists in the Stonewall headquarters. And Pride was coming up, and their theme was Lesbi Gay Holiday. And we felt kind of hurt that the trans community was left out of that. So as a prank, we put some pieces of paper and some markers together and strung up a big banner that says Lesbi Gator Holiday, adding the TR on the end. And they were not amused. They said, how dare you insinuate yourself on us? We know what we're doing, and we do not want to include trans in this. And we had to push them to include trans in their mission, and they didn't want to. But eventually, with enough pushing and enough repeated asking, they included trans on their workspace. And then they invited one of us to be on the board, which turned out to be Sarah Fox. And she was on the board for a while. And after her turn, I came onto the Stonewall board.
You were able to advance other accomplishments at Lucent as well. Can you talk a little bit about the healthcare benefits?
Now, keep in mind that I had not transitioned yet. I still identified as a crossdresser. And yet I networked with other trans Lucent employees. We had a small group that we called Trans Lucent. And one of them was a transsexual who was in the process of getting her surgery and couldn't get Lucent to pay for the surgery. And I heard from many of my transsexual friends, as trans women were known at the time, they were known as Marianne's transsexual friends. I'm kidding. I heard from them that it was a big hardship for them to pay for their surgery because it was like saving up to pay cash for a car. And I didn't think it was fair. They didn't think it was fair, certainly, that the medical insurance plans had an exclusion clause that said, we do not pay for anything related to a sex change. And that mostly meant surgery because people found ways to get the mental health and the hormones covered. But I kept asking Lucent, will you cover the surgery? And they said no. And I asked again, will you cover the surgery? And then got ignored. And then the answer came back, well, we've always covered the surgery. And I know how to take yes for an answer. So I followed up on that. And when this woman showed me a copy of the check that had reimbursed her for her surgery, then I felt, yes, this is real. It's been accomplished. Lucent really covers the trans health benefits. So a few years later, 2001, I think it was, in 2001, Lynn Conway put out a back of the envelope estimate that said she thought that the surgeries would be inexpensive to cover because there were so few surgeries being done. And she guessed at a number of how many surgeries would be done. And she didn't have the numbers. And I thought, you know, there aren't that many surgeons that everybody goes to. And I know how to do statistics. I have a PhD. So maybe I can do a survey of these surgeons and actually count how many people are getting surgeries. So I put together a very quick little survey with three questions on it. How many surgeries did you do in calendar year 2001, M to F and F to M? And how much did you charge for those? And what percent of them were U.S. residents? And at the time, Jamison Green and I put our heads together and we came up with a list of 15 surgeons going in either direction from the U.S. would go to. And so I sent the survey to those 15 surgeons and I got 12 excellent responses back, which is an astounding 80% response rate. That was great. And I found out the 13th person, he refused to cooperate, but Jennifer Finney Boylan's memoir had those numbers in the back, as it turns out. So I was able to get data for 13 of the 15 surgeons. So I got really good data. And I was able to get both information on the prevalence of transgender in the population to make good estimates, and also the costs. And I found out that people who are actually having surgery or at least needing some kind of medical care are just the tip of the iceberg, that 3-6% of the population could be considered transgender, at least a one on the Benjamin scale, people who've dressed, you know, once maybe for Halloween or something like that and gotten something out of it. And yet a very small number of surgeries were done. I think it was about 11,000 surgeries in 2001. So I could crunch the numbers, and it turned out that in order to cover full trans health benefits, including the counseling, the hormones, the doctor's office visits to support the hormones, the lab tests, and the surgeries itself would add a cost of 17 cents per insured to the employer's health costs, which worked out to 0.004% of their total cost. Basically, it's the change in your counts. It's a rounding error. So I was able to turn that into a paper and into a workshop. And I gave that workshop at the Out and Equal conference for several years. And the idea was, here are the numbers. You HR human resources people and employee resource group people can take this back to your companies, and you can show that it's not going to cost you anything in order to add these benefits, but it's going to get you more points on the corporate equality index, which, again, we've been asking HRC to add health coverage to the corporate equality index, and they added it a few years later. So now there was a carrot there as well. So then it took off. People were adding the coverage because they wanted that 100% rating on the corporate equality index. And it's to the point now that I think the last survey that came out from HRC, 92% of Fortune 500 companies have EO language that's trans inclusive, and 62% of them have coverage for medically necessary, what we now call gender affirming care.
It's actually a low number. I thought it would be a much higher number than 62%. That's interesting. I remember hearing all of this information, and I'm wondering if it's when I was working at Out and Equal Workplace Advocates and I was attending the Chicago conference in 2005, that maybe you gave the presentation there and I went and listened to it. I also remember, even though I was on staff, we were able to go into some of the workshops. I remember Jameson Green is not only a friend of mine, he's also a collaborator and he's my mentor. And so for the last 20 years, I've been able to pick his brain and do some really good work with him. And I remember him telling me a story back in the day about how, and you probably already know this story, but working with the city and county of San Francisco to add non-discrimination language like you did at Lucent, they went ahead and did that. And then he said, oh, by the way, you're now out of compliance with your non-discrimination policy because you don't allow trans people access to medical care through the health insurance plan. They were like, wait, what? So ultimately they fixed that. And they did what you recommended. They added a minuscule dollar amount to each payer for the plan. And at the end of that first year, they had a surplus. And so I think they lowered it, but didn't get rid of it. And by the end of the second year, even larger surplus. And so they just removed the added cost off the top from the payer because it turned out that there weren't maybe as many people coming forward for surgery, or they weren't having as costly surgeries, whatever it was, that it turned out that it didn't even have to cost more, but they were prepared just in case. And I would imagine you mentioned that you worked together to reach out to those, determine who those surgeons were. So I would think that you were either a good influence on Jameson or you were equally influencing each other in that work. Either way, it was good work.
Jameson and I influenced each other, definitely. I can't take any credit for San Francisco, but I heard the stories and he told me about it. And the data from San Francisco, that their actual experience backed up the numbers that I'd calculated, turned out to be a very valuable tool in the workplace, because we could say, it's not just these theoretical numbers that Marianne came up with, but look at San Francisco, they're not spending anything on this. And look at Lucent, they're not spending anything on this. It's not costing them anything. And it got to the point that when I came to San Diego Gas and Electric in 2007 and got to work with them, they didn't cover the trans health benefits when I got there, but they reached out to me and said, help educate us on this. And I did. I did a workshop for them. And they said, we're going to work with our medical providers and we're going to insist that they cover it. And we're going to tell them, don't charge us anything extra for it because it's not going to cost anything. We're insisting on that. And they were absolutely right. It's been found over and over that the costs to cover are negligible.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening
to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Dr. Mary Ann Horton, a computer scientist and transgender activist, chats about transgender inclusion in the workplace and her award-winning memoir, Trailblazer. We are grateful to our sponsors and therefore grateful to play their commercials. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena-sensitive care pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena-sensitive care pads with the skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour is Dr. Mary Ann Horton, who is an award-winning transgender activist, computer systems architect, internet pioneer, entrepreneur, award-winning author of Trailblazer, Lighting the Path for Transgender Equality in Corporate America, and speaker. Let's get back to where we left off.
They're not even significant. And in fact, I don't have the data to back this up, but it's widely believed that it's actually a cost savings, because when you treat trans people fairly, then their mental health costs will go down and their job productivity will go up. So they're not even significant. There's a net savings because you're not spending money on counseling for depression or anxiety or whatever other causes might happen from trying to repress being transgender.
Did you have any pushback from anyone during that time period?
One of the wonderful things about working with HR and diversity folks during the time period when I was doing my activism is that diversity people were pretty much on the same page as I was. Being trans is part of diversity, and properly covering our medical benefits, there was precedent for that. There were domestic partner benefits that gay and lesbian people wanted. And it was exactly the same argument that if you're going to cover domestic partner benefits and be fair to gay and lesbian people, then you should cover trans health benefits and be fair to transgender people as well. Really, the only pushback that I remember is on being an out crossdresser in the workplace, because I came out in the workplace in 98 as a crossdresser. I didn't transition until 2001. So there was a period of time when I was cross-dressing in the workplace part-time. And some of the time I would come to work as Mark, and some of the time I would come to work as Mary Ann. And all the transsexual activists that I'm working with thought I was crazy and said, you can't do that. You're messing this up for us, because everybody will think that we all want to cross-dress part-time and they'll think that we're crazy. I was considered to be very much on the edge by advocating not just for transsexuals, but also for cross-dressers. And my response was, those who say something can't be done should get out of the way of those of us who are doing it. So I had no problem with cross-dressing part-time in the workplace because I was the first out trans person. And in the eyes of HR, all trans people were like me. So they accommodated that, except for the restroom. And the restroom, they designated one single occupancy restroom that I could go to, which was a quarter mile from my workplace, until eventually, a few years later, I convinced them to change the policy and say the restroom that a trans person uses should be the one that matches their current presentation, which I call the principle of least astonishment. I've heard from other directors of diversity that gender flip-flopping in the workplace can't be done, that corporate America can't deal with it. And that's simply not true. I did it for 4 years and it worked out just fine. I had to be flexible about what name people called me, and I had to be flexible about what pronoun people called me, because if I was on the phone, they didn't know which mode I was in on that particular day. So I took the position that my name is Mark, my nickname is Marianne. You can call me whichever one you want. If you want to be especially supportive, you can call me by the one that matches my gender presentation on that particular day. And that was hard because I really wanted people to call me by the right name. But that was the one price that I had to pay in order to be able to cross-dress in the workplace, was I needed to be flexible about the name and the pronouns people used around me.
That's really interesting. I've had a number of conversations with people just over the course of my lifetime. And just for example, if I were in the arts world, which I've been, it's never really an issue. Yeah, there's liberty to move either direction. As soon as you cross over into the business world, there are all these restrictions that appear, and it becomes more difficult to, I think, be able to have some freedom to express. It's not quite as easy. So all during this time, as you were going back and forth, did you actually witness people who initially had a strong reaction, if at all, come around to the idea that they were adapting and starting to get comfortable with the changes?
Well, I very quickly found a way to come out and a process and a dialogue for coming out, because Lucent offered a prize to the first person who would come out to 50 people. And I wanted that prize. So I made it a point to come out to all kinds of random people in the workplace just to count and come up with that prize. So I came out in the form, I've couched it in terms of diversity. And if people had a problem with it, they knew they needed to keep their mouth shut because it was a diversity thing. But I did get the occasional reaction. I remember one time when I had come to work as Marianne, and I'm walking my quarter mile to the bathroom through all kinds of space that was full of projects that I wasn't affiliated with. And I happened to pass in the hallway a guy that I knew, and he knew me as Mark, and I hadn't come out to him yet. Here I was in Marianne mode, and he did a double take and he started laughing because cross-dressing males was considered comedy material at the time. So I went into my little spiel and explained to him who I was and what I was all about. And he was nice, but he just couldn't keep a straight face. He kept cracking up. And that was a little bit painful. But I had to resolve that I was able to bring some joy into his life. So then this was a good thing. And after a while, it just became routine, and people would look at me and they would immediately switch the pronoun to whichever one was appropriate.
I don't think a lot of people know that Lou Sullivan, who is considered to be one of the pioneers of the FTM community, was a champion for what he called female-to-male cross-dressers and transsexuals, because he considered himself to be a cross-dresser. He acknowledged that he was female, but he wanted to present in the world like a man, and he had boyfriends. He was attracted to men. And it wasn't until when he was a little bit older and he moved to San Francisco and he had access to hormones and surgeries that then he became a transsexual. But he initially referred to himself as a crossdresser, and he took the name Lou before he transitioned. A lot of people don't know that about him. So I like hearing your story because I think it's actually, I don't know if it's more common, but I think it's definitely part of our history. A lot of times people get rolled up into one category. I know that, for example, oftentimes people will refer to Sylvia Rivera and Martha P. Johnson as trans women, transsexual women. But I didn't know them personally, but I was friends with people who did know them. And they would say they were queens, right? They were street queens, which was part of gay culture. They were gay men who presented as female looking while they were sex working. They called them street queens. Things were so different. And so I like being able to say there was a time when we had full-time and part-time cross-dressers, and then we also had transsexuals, and then we had street queens, then we also had transgenderists, right, with Virginia Prince. And in between, it's like a full-time cross-dresser who's on hormones but isn't going to have surgeries. People don't understand that there were so many different, we didn't call them identities, but there were just different ways that we were living our life. We had different terms, and they varied at times geographically or demographically, but that's just the way it's been. And so I like to hear your story, and I like to share about Lou. I have a question for you, Marianne, because it seems quite timely, because you're mentioning a lot about diversity and how important it is. And we don't want groupthink in the workplace. We want a lot of diverse input into projects or services or programs or whatever it is that we're working on. I personally think that one of the types of diversity that gets overlooked is diversity of thought. We tend to go a lot more towards the other types of diversity, like racial and ethnic and sexual orientation and gender and these kinds of things. But I have two questions. One is, what is your take on this, if you can speak to it, that your take on this executive order, the current executive order, about DEI in the federal workplace? I'd also like to know if you are doing any consulting, right? Are you helping businesses, regardless of size, to develop policies or to strengthen policies or to, yeah, what's your take and what are you doing of late?
So, yeah, there's some terrible things going on in Washington right now, and they're beyond horrible. And they make no logical sense at all. They're not based on data. They're not based on facts. They're based on feelings by the right wing and by one particular individual who seems to have ridiculous amounts of power right now. And they've decided DEI is now a buzzword, which is suddenly a bad thing. And diversity has always been a positive thing ever since the word came into widespread use. There was first equal opportunity, and then there was affirmative action, and affirmative action became diversity. When I was working, everything was called diversity, and that was such a powerful thing. It was understood by business leaders, and I think it's still understood by business leaders, that when a decision is being made, the more diverse the group that's making the decision, the better a decision is going to get made. And diversity in that sense can be about anything. It can be about race. It can be about gender. It can be about thought. It can be about age. It can be about ability. It can be about what part of the company you're from. There's what part of the country you're from, what part of the world you're from. Many, many, many ways to measure diversity. And for any particular situation, any of those might come into play. So diversity has always been a very powerful thing in the workplace, and CEOs understand that. And that's why they have HR folks do, among all the various things that HR does, to encourage diversity, so that you want to have many different points of view there. And diversity is different than discrimination. Discrimination says you favor one particular group over another particular group. But the way I was taught, diversity and all those other things, affirmative action and inclusion, are all about making sure that everybody feels empowered in order to apply for positions, to work equally, and to get a diverse pool of applicants so that the best qualified candidates can apply and the best qualified candidate can be the one who's chosen for the job. rather than discouraging people of difference so that they don't even apply in the first place, or they aren't properly trained or educated in the first place, giving people an opportunity so that we have a level playing field. And if we ever get to the point where we have a quota, say, well, we need more X people because we don't have enough, so we're going to favor this person who's less qualified because they're X rather than this person who's better qualified because they're not X, that would be a problem. And that is not what normally happens in hiring. That's why you have a non-discrimination policy that says we do not discriminate based on race or sex or sexual orientation or gender identity or whatever, which means that the straight white cis people are just as empowered to apply and to work as the people of difference. So it's supposed to give us all a level playing field. It is not supposed to give anybody an advantage over anybody else. There apparently have been some admissions decisions in universities that did have quotas, and I can't speak to those because I have no experience, but in general, I'm not in favor of having quotas. So what am I doing lately? Well, I'm retired. So I wrote a book and I've done a lot of appearances. This is one of them as a result of having written that book. My book, by the way, is called Trailblazer, Lighting the Path for Transgender Equality in Corporate America. And it's a memoir about my personal story as a trans woman and as a trans activist. It came out in 2022 on the 25th anniversary of Lucent's policy. And I've done quite a few speaking engagements and podcasts and appearances and book signings and so forth as a result of that book. And that's given me the opportunity to speak out a little bit more. So with all this visibility, I'm not formally engaged as an activist. I've done consulting in the past, helping companies with someone who's transitioning to educate their employees. I've done plenty of consulting in the past, helping companies with a trans person who's transitioning on the job to educate their coworkers about what this is all about and why it's okay. I've worked with HR departments to help them set their policies so that they have a written policy that says, here's what we do when a person transitions in the workplace. Here's our policy on restrooms. Here's our policy on dress codes. Here's our policy on health benefits. Here's our non-discrimination policy. Those sorts of things. So I've done those. I haven't done many of them recently because most companies now have those policies in place and the need isn't there so much. That may change. Some companies are walking that back, may need to do some additional work to bring them up to speed again. So, you know, I'm open to those kinds of opportunities. But mostly I'm semi-retired, living in San Diego, doing some tech consulting work for San Diego Gas and Electric, doing cybersecurity consulting work specifically to make sure they're in compliance with all the regulations in order to keep the hackers out of the power grid. And that's a very fun job. It's a techie job, and I like doing techie work. So I'm semi-retired, and I get to enjoy living in paradise in San Diego. Life is personally very good for me right now.
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Dr. Mary Ann Horton. Dr. Horton was instrumental in 1997 persuading Lucent Technologies to become the first Fortune 500 company to add transgender inclusive language to its non-discrimination policy and to add coverage for transition care and surgery. Her work, which was soon replicated at Apple and Avaya, led out an Equal Workplace Associates to present her with the 2001 Trailblazer Audi Award, since renamed the LGBT Corporate Advocate of the Year, inspiring her to write her award-winning memoir, Trailblazer, Lighting the Path for Transgender Inclusion in Corporate America. Let's take our break. We will be back shortly.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg, and our guest this hour is Dr. Mary Ann Horton, a computer scientist and transgender activist, here to discuss transgender inclusion in the workplace and her award-winning memoir, Trailblazer. Let's get back to where we left off.
I've spent most of my adult life, well, most of my life, even as a child in San Diego. So I'm no longer there, but it is, as I mentioned to you before we started recording, it's a home in my heart because it's where I've spent most of my life. And it is an absolutely beautiful place to live. So I'm glad that you're there and you're enjoying it. I'm also glad that you segued into your book because that's where I was going. So not only is the title of the book Trailblazer, but it won a book award. Tell us a little bit more about who gave you this book award and what's the book award for. And congratulations, by the way, that's quite an honor.
Well, thanks. Thank you so much for your kind words. One of the things that comes along with being visible is awards tend to happen. The name Trailblazer is actually the first major award that I got. Out and Equal Workplace Associates in 2001 gave their Audi Award. And I was nominated for the Trailblazer Award, which is the award for the LGBT person who's done the most in the workplace. And I was nominated specifically for the work with Lucent and Avaya on their EO policy and their trans health benefits. And I was the winner of that award in 2001. So I get to legitimately name my book Trailblazer. It's not just a title I made up for myself. That's the award I'm most proud of. And the trophy for that is prominently on my wall. My book has also won some awards. There are various book awards that go out, and I've submitted it to different categories, to LGBT books, to memoirs and biographies, to nonfiction business books. And in a couple of cases, I've won multiple awards for those. Well, one of the things that happens when you get involved with author groups is you get on mailing lists and you very quickly find out there are a lot of book awards out there. And sometimes they'll mail you and invite you to submit. And sometimes you'll hear about them through the author groups. So now I'm getting requests to apply for awards, and it's to the point where I'm not going to pay somebody just to give me an award from somebody I've never heard of. I applied to the Bookfest Awards, which is a well-known set of awards, and they awarded three different categories to Trailblazer. The first place for the nonfiction professional memoir, and first place for nonfiction LGBTQ plus books, and first place for nonfiction business leadership, harassment, and discrimination books. It's been an honor. It's been quite a ride. doing all the publicity for these and getting to talk to people. And I hear from people every once in a while that read my book, and somehow it's helped them in their life. Either they've been inspired to come out in the workplace and get involved as an activist, or it's a grandparent and their grandchild is trans and it's helped them understand what their grandchild is going through. And it's just really heartwarming to hear from people and find out that my book has really helped somebody.
Marianne, you mentioned something about you weren't going to pay anyone to give you an award. And I know that that tends to be a thing, or if you're asked to do a speaking engagement, the steps to maybe getting some recognition.
Well, usually either they pay me as the speaker, sometimes there's an honorarium, or if it's some a church group or nonprofit group like the local LGBT center, or I'm a Lutheran and I've given lots of talks to various Lutheran congregations and groups. Obviously, I'm not going to charge them for it. And sometimes the nonprofits will give me an honorarium as well, or give me the opportunity to sit at a table and sell books afterwards and sign books for people. The most expensive part is if I want a booth at some kind of a festival, then I have to pay a fee for that. And if I want a booth at a Pride festival, it's a lot of money to buy a booth. And it's just, it doesn't make economic sense. I would love to sit there at a Pride festival and sell books and sign them for people. And I kind of can't afford it.
It's really interesting to me on how every once in a while I'll get something through LinkedIn. We'd like you to be in the who's who of such and such, but you have to pay for that. Or we'd like to feature you in our magazine as somebody doing whatever you're doing. And there's a cost with it. And it's somewhere in the $1,500 to $3,000 price, depending on how much information, how much color there is, where in the magazine it is, in the front or the back, the middle.
There's the same kind of thing going on in book publishing. If you have a legitimate book, you should be able to receive royalties for it. And there will be expenses associated with publishing. An editor costs money, cover design costs money, marketing costs money. And either the author pays those fees directly and hires somebody to do them, or you get a publisher, if you're lucky enough to get a publisher, and the publisher pays for it and then takes it out of your royalties until you make it back. But there's a whole nother category of publishers called Vanity Press. And they will gladly take you through the whole publishing process. And they'll provide an editor and a coach and graphics, covers, and interior design and all that stuff. And they'll do it for the low, low price of $12,000 to $20,000. And those books won't sell in any place. You'll get a few copies for your family, and you can get all the copies you want that you can go around and sell yourself, but they aren't seriously marketed. And those are just there for people who want to publish something and don't really have a readership in mind.
Marianne, thank you so much. I have really enjoyed just learning more about you and the work that you did. Trailblazer makes sense. I would add in pioneer. Trailblazer, pioneer, perhaps they're synonymous, but thank you so much for all of the work that you've done, that you are continuing to do, because you're sharing your story now through your book. And just thank you also for taking the time to come on the Umbrella Hour and to share your story with us.
Thank you for having me here. I will mention that I'm working on another book. It's a memoir about my technical accomplishments. And the working title of that book is Internet Pioneer. Okay, thanks so much. Nice to meet you, Ann. Good to see you, Xander.
It was great meeting you. We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. Our guest this hour was Dr. Marianne Horton. We sure hope you enjoyed the segment of this hour. Thank you for listening.